By now, you've probably heard the sound of automatic gunfire in the cell phone videos circulating from Sunday night's music festival concert on the Las Vegas Strip. Concertgoers ran and ducked for cover. They were confused, unsure whether they should run or stay down. Some were trampled, others rushed in to save more lives. Dozens of people dead, hundreds injured. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're learning the latest on this mass shooting with Alana Abramson. She's a reporter for the websites of Fortune and Time. She's been covering the Las Vegas shooting. Alana, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Can you bring us up to speed on what we know the latest on the death toll, injuries?
Yeah. So the Las Vegas police gave a briefing last night, and they said that the death toll had climbed to 59 with 527 injured. That was as of last night. That could change this morning. The numbers could continue to climb. Authorities are likely to give another address.
Over the past 24 hours, law enforcement has tried to put this puzzle together. What have we learned about the shooter, Stephen Paddock?
So we've learned a little bit more, but we still don't really know his motive. Authorities do believe that he acted alone. He had really no police record, maybe a minor traffic violation. He had purchased the guns that he used earlier this year. But
dozens of them.
Objects.
Yeah, dozens of guns. Is that right?
So there were 23 guns that were found in his hotel room, and then 19 additional guns were found at his home in Mesquite, Nevada. Excuse my pronunciation. And then authorities are also searching a home in Reno, so more could turn up there. But yeah, multiple dozens of guns and ammunitions were found. But authorities think that he had to have modified the guns to make them even more powerful.
So do we know where he bought these guns or how he acquired so many of them?
So we know that he purchased a gun at a gun store in Mesquite. I believe it was in May, and the gun store owner said that he had met all of the background checks for that. But they do believe that he had to have done something to make them even more powerful. But, I mean, he was in compliance with the laws in Nevada.
Of course, the authorities have been tracing family members, trying to find people who knew him. What did family say about him?
So the family said, they really said he had no political agenda. Really, he just gambled. I know his brother has been telling reporters that his dad was a con man and a bank robber who was on the run, and that his dad had actually escaped from prison in 1969 and was on the FBI's most wanted list, but they didn't know that, and they thought he was dead growing up. The brother has basically said that he never really had any interest in politics or ever had any sort of political agenda or racial agenda, anything like that.
So are we in agreement at all as a country over whether this mass shooting is considered domestic terrorism?
So in terms of just in general, I'll start from the beginning. Obviously, we know that ISIS claimed a connection with the attacker, but they didn't provide any evidence. And then the FBI has refuted that, said that there was no connection with an international terror group, and the shooter and authorities are saying he likely acted alone. So when the press secretary at the White House was asked about this yesterday, she did not say that, she did not confirm that it was domestic terrorism, and she did not confirm that it was not domestic terrorism. She said, "We're still in a fact-finding mission. This is an ongoing investigation, and it would be premature to weigh in on something like that before we have any more facts. And we'll leave that to local law enforcement to work with, and also the federal law enforcement to make those determinations." So it sounds like the White House will not classify this as domestic terrorism until the FBI has explicitly done so.
In the hours after the shooting, there was a lot of, it seemed, misinformation coming out, as often is the case when things like this happen. What false information, if any, might still be out there creating confusion for law enforcement or other officials?
So I'm not sure that this information has been confusing for law enforcement. You know, they've been very vehement about the fact that if you see any false information, you should report it to them. But they've been also, you know, stressing the fact that false information is out there and you should really rely on what people are saying, the local authorities have said. But I know that as soon as the news broke early yesterday morning, Google, an article from 4chan was at the top of Google's news. So, and that is where it was spreading false information. And then on Facebook, there was also an article from the Gateway Pundit, which is not necessarily considered a legitimate news outlet. It's been grouped in fake news outlets. So I think the algorithms were, I think the Facebook news algorithms, and there are people who can speak with more authority on this, had originally left some false information up for a few hours. And then that combined with the hoaxes that were getting spread about the shootings and the conspiracy theories, I think, to set off a wave of misinformation that the news was quick to correct.
Talking right now with Alana Abramson. She's a reporter for the websites of Fortune and Time magazine. She's been covering the mass shooting in Las Vegas late Sunday night, the death toll now rising to 59. Alana, I was listening to our program 1A yesterday afternoon, and a listener called in and said, I want the media to stop saying that this is the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history, because this person said, you know what, it's going to compel someone to up that, to up the ante, and to do something more horrendous. What is your feedback on that?
I mean, I think saying it's the deadliest shooting in modern U.S. history is probably, I get where that viewer is coming from, but it is the deadliest shooting in modern U.S. history. I mean, the death toll surpassed Orlando. I think that, you know, I think there's a way of saying it without necessarily, well, I mean, I think that it's important to state the facts. And then I think that I'm not sure that saying that this is the deadliest shooting would, that not, I'm sorry, let me get my thoughts together. I don't think that not saying it would necessarily stop another shooting from happening. I think that, you know, there's other reasons that it would happen. Maybe that person would try and kill more people, but I also think that, you know, I think that as the media, you have to report the facts, and that's technically what's been going on.
So what else specifically will investigators be looking at in the coming days and weeks?
I think they will be, so the Mesquite police said that they handed over, they had a warrant to raid Mr. Paddock's house in Mesquite, and they handed all that over. I think they'll be looking at that, but looking at hard drives. You know, they haven't been so forthcoming about exactly what they will be examining, but they'll be examining the contents of this home, what was in the hotel room, things like that.
And what are officials saying that concerned individuals can do to help in this situation? Because here we are almost bystanders in this.
Yeah, so the official said yesterday that the best way to help is there's a GoFundMe account that was set up by the commissioner that's raised over $2 million. And officials said that, honestly, donating there is the best way to help. And then if you're in Las Vegas, go and donate blood.
And what are you going to be watching for as you cover this unfolding story? And what are the news pegs coming in future days?
I mean, I think today depends, frankly, what my editor puts me on. I likely will be, you know, watching the Las Vegas authorities and seeing if they raise the death toll, if the number of injured increases. And I think, you know, seeing what else they have to say about the investigation. I will also, I think a coming story in the next few days is it domestic terrorism? What will the upcoming debate on gun laws be? I know that Nancy Pelosi had sent a letter to Paul Ryan asking for a bipartisan congressional committee to investigate solutions to these problems. So, you know, seeing that response, things like that. I think it's really the focus is going to be the investigation. What was his motive, and will this change the gun laws at all in the U.S.?
Alana, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Alana Abramson is a reporter for the websites of Fortune and Time magazine. We're following developments in the mass shooting in Las Vegas late Sunday night. You can weigh in 800-642-1234. What is on your mind about the Las Vegas shooting? And we will be continuing to follow this news, digesting it, finding out how to cope with trauma when we come back. Stay with us. Nevada's University Medical Center dealt with a surge of trauma patients after a gunman opened fire on a Las Vegas country music festival Sunday night. We don't know yet the details about the specific injuries of the victims. We do know that survivors will be living with trauma for the rest of their life. Some 22,000 people were in the crowd when the gunman opened fire. We're discussing the psychological trauma of mass shootings in this segment with Susan Silk. She's a disaster mental health volunteer and trainer for the American Red Cross and has responded to hurricanes, flooding, airplane accidents, earthquakes, terrorism, and school shootings. Susan, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Well, how do traumatic events like mass shootings affect people? What is the impact?
Well, It depends on who you are, who you are the day before it happened, and then where you are when this happened. I mean, of course, for the people on the ground in Las Vegas, it's like suddenly having, you know, being in a combat situation with all of the fears of life and death that are attendant to that. But I think what we're also probably talking about is the ripple effect for those of us who were not on the ground in Las Vegas, but who witnessed it or who heard about it or who know people who were there. In that respect, I think it's sort of similar to the Boston Marathon, where it was a public event where people had every expectation of going and enjoying themselves and having, you know, exciting day out, and it all of a sudden turned into something very different. And when it turns into that something very different, of course people are frightened, of course people are overwhelmed, and then there's some kind of cognitive and behavioral reactions that people don't necessarily expect. People become very distracted, people have trouble concentrating, short-term memory is impaired, there are sleep disturbances, there may be appetite disturbances, and I think something that people need to recognize is that it may also trigger feelings about previous losses, whether they were violent or whether they were natural, but just the sense of being out of control and the things that have happened to us.
Going back to your thoughts on it's akin to being in a combat situation, we know soldiers who come back from war areas often have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Is this something that could trigger a PTSD situation for some people?
Well, I think that it's important because we have so many combat veterans now in our lives from the last 20, 25 years of the war, and you know, we still have some survivors of Vietnam, and there's no question in my mind that for some of the individuals who were in Las Vegas who have had those experiences in real life in earlier in their lives, this no doubt reminded them of that, and that it may have triggered some of those feelings. The other, though, important thing is that for, you know, combat veterans, I mean, when they're in country, when they're in a war zone, there's some expectation that something like this might happen. Whereas, of course, you know, if I'm a civilian and I'm going to a rock concert, it's the last, you know, I'm looking at how long the line is for a beer and where the bathroom is. I'm certainly not looking to figure out where I'm supposed to take cover.
You've responded to a number of traumatic events as a disaster mental health volunteer and a trainer. When you arrive on the ground, what kind of work do you do?
Well, it depends where I'm assigned. I suspect that right now there are disaster mental health workers who are assigned to the trauma centers, to the hospitals in Las Vegas. And they're working perhaps with family members who have come in to comfort and to be with and to be comforted in the aftermath of this shooting. So we would have people, the Red Cross would make sure that there were people who were able to attend to the families of the wounded and to the wounded themselves, in conjunction with the hospital staff that's already on place to do that. I'm not sure what the logistics look like in Las Vegas right now, but it's likely that for all of the people who have come in from out of town, there's also something like a family reception center.
Yeah.
And we would provide support for family from out of town or family from nearby in a family center. The other thing about this, which is similar to, you know, an airplane crash, is that there are different loci, there are different locuses, which is that I suspect that for this concert, there were people from all the western states. I suspect that there were people who drove, and because Las Vegas is such a tourist mecca, I assume, but I haven't had a chance to look, but I assume there were people from all over, certainly the western United States. And so what we would do, because we're a national organization, is that we would get some information about the survivors or about the concert goers, and we would have an opportunity to reach out to people in their hometown, either when people came back, those who survived, or to some of the families that live in places other than Las Vegas.
And who would you reach out to in those towns? Like, what support systems?
Well, I guess
systems?
What we would do, because we don't want to intrude on someone's privacy,
yeah.
I think we would work with people like you, the local radio stations, and we would let people know that if they had any concerns, if they needed any assistance, that they could call us.
Yeah, and, you know, what are the challenges in helping victims of a shooting and their loved ones recover when they are coming in from all over? I can imagine that there are plane loads of people, perhaps, coming to find their victims, whether they are alive or in hospitals, in surgeries, and I can imagine it's pretty chaotic.
From my previous experience, I would say that the Red Cross is on site with an army of volunteers, and not just disaster mental health people, but people who are doing the mundane things like making sure that people who are there have food, making sure that they have lodging, people who might be coming in from out of town. So we would be working with all the survivors, people in the hospital. Let's start with people in the hospital, or let's perhaps start with the deceased. And working with the public health officials and the emergency management people in Las Vegas to find out who their family was and helping to make arrangements for those people to come in and working with the airlines who also have, which you may not know, most airlines also have teams of emergency mental health people.
Talking right now with Susan Silk. She's a disaster mental health volunteer and trainer for the American Red Cross, has responded to hurricanes and flooding, airplane accidents, earthquakes, terrorism, school shootings, and we're welcoming your thoughts. How are you feeling after the mass shooting in Las Vegas? How are you handling your distress? 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@WPR.org, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Do you know someone who was killed or injured? How do you hope to support them or their loved ones? 800-642-1234. Susan, what tips do you have for the general public as they address their distress over this mass shooting in Las Vegas? Certainly the cell phone videos that are out there on Facebook, people watching these over and over.
Well, the first thing that I would like to say is, well, two things. One is that abnormal reactions are a normal reaction to an abnormal event. Let's let that sink in. The fact that you may be tearful, the fact that you may be distracted, the fact that you may be having all kinds of reactions, emotional and behavioral reactions that you didn't have 3 days ago, is a quite a normal reaction to something this catastrophic, especially to the extent that you are connected with this. Those of us who were, you know, in Las Vegas 3 weeks ago are like, wow, that could have been me. Or, geez, I better check my Facebook and see if I know anybody who was at that concert. And the fact that we have those emotional reactions is very normal. But the other side of that coin is that the bad news is that we may feel terrible for a while. We may feel very agitated. We may feel very distracted. We may have all these reactions. The good news is that for most of us, by a vast, vast majority, we will, by Halloween, which is, say, 4 weeks away, the intensity of these reactions will have significantly diminished. So the abnormal reactions right now are normal, but the good news is that for most of us, they will not persist. And if you do find that, say, by after Halloween or by Thanksgiving, you're still very disturbed by this, then it's time to find a counselor to talk to.
And what about trying to talk with children about what happened in Las Vegas?
Well, children, I mean, one thing that you have to do for kids, and we found this out after 9/11, is that when children saw replays, they thought it was happening again and again. They didn't understand that this was just a replay. So I think we have to be very, 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 very careful about the amount of exposure that children see. And I think it depends on the age of the children, but with very, very young children, I think that you can reassure them that they're going to be okay, you know, and that mom and dad are going to be okay. That I think with very, very little kids, I believe that you can say, you know, this is not going to happen to mom and dad. Mom and dad are going to come home after the concert. That, you know, you've got a babysitter, and mom and dad are coming home afterwards, and we'll be there in the morning to make you breakfast. As children get older, you know, obviously you can't give them that blanket reassurance, and that's hard.
And how should people support those affected by the tragedy? Because in a way you feel helpless and they are in such a different situation.
People who are closer to the event need to be supported unconditionally. No questions asked. And yes, we feel disturbed, but we need to provide comfort to those who were closer to the situation than we were. Anybody who knows anyone who was there, of course anybody who was injured, of course anyone who was a survivor of someone who didn't survive, even maybe anybody who was on the strip that day who comes home very shook up. Yes, it's also natural for us to vicariously have feelings about that, but perhaps we could be sensitive and share our feelings of anxiety with somebody who's even one step more removed. So we would comfort in and vent out. So draw a circle around the people who were killed, of course, the people who were injured, the people who were at the concert, people who knew those people, and then us. And as we're providing support for people in those inner concentric circles, let's say, you know, what can I do for you? Or can I pick up the kids from school? Shall I drop by and we'll have a cup of coffee? How about we take the dogs for a walk? And if you want to talk about this, you can. And if you don't, that's okay, too. And then to the extent that we have our own feelings about that, you or me, assuming that we don't have a more direct connection, then to the extent that we're shook up, which we certainly may be, then we find somebody else in our circle to speak to about our feelings. Because it's, you know, but I don't want anybody to hear that I'm not validating their own feelings. I mean, everybody has their own feelings, and everybody grieves and mourns and reacts to these things in their own individual way, and there is no one right way to do that. Mm. For some, it's very apparent. For some, it's very obvious. And for some, it's more subtle. And that's what's difficult, is that for the people whose reaction is more covert, more interior, it's important that we not assume that they're not reacting. And it's also important that we don't force them to express themselves in a way that's not comfortable for them.
Is it normal, Susan Silk, for someone who has been in a situation like this but come out of it on the other end, perhaps physically unharmed, will there be fear to go into public situations, perhaps?
Oh, of course.
Boarding an airplane, again, or going to a concert or the grocery store, for that matter.
Absolutely. And the closer they are to the event, I mean, time-wise, temporally, the more likely they are to have those kinds of reactions and those kinds of feelings. There's a term that we use. I would say that anybody, what were there, about 23,000 people there,
yeah,
who heard those shots, and then, of course, probably people who weren't tickle holders who heard those shots. Those people are very likely to have a reaction that we call hypervigilance. So vigilance is just, you know, being careful and looking around. Hypervigilance is, I think, what you're talking about, that they're much more easily startled. So if they hear a car backfire, if they hear a door slam, if somebody drops a stack of books, that's a person whose heart rate is going to increase, who's going to hit the ground. If you maybe even tap that person on the shoulder unawares, they're going to spin around with their heart in their mouth. And that's a normal reaction to something like this. In addition to, even though, you know, there's no way that anybody could have seen this coming, I mean, this guy was not visible to any of the people who were hurt. We are going to do what we think we can do to make ourselves safe. We're going to scan our environment carefully. We're going to look around. We may, in fact, as you say, we may avoid crowds for a while. But most people, again, are amazingly resilient. I mean, it's really uncanny. You mentioned the example of combat and soldiers and PTSD. I mean, of course, we're sensitive to that now, but isn't it remarkable that most of our soldiers come back without that?
And I'm going to leave it there at amazingly resilient. Susan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Susan Silk is a disaster mental health volunteer and trainer for the American Red Cross, and she's responded to many disasters. President Trump has called for national unity after the Las Vegas mass shooting. He plans to visit Las Vegas tomorrow. It's being described as the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history. President Trump yesterday delivered somber remarks about the Las Vegas shooting. Let's take a listen.
Hundreds of our fellow citizens are now mourning the sudden loss of a loved one, a parent, a child, a brother or sister. We cannot fathom their pain. We cannot imagine their loss. To the families of the victims, we are praying for you, and we are here for you.
President Trump's televised remarks yesterday after a lone gunman killed 59 people on the Las Vegas Strip. Reports now around 529 people injured. President Trump plans to visit Las Vegas tomorrow. What is your reaction to this weekend's mass shooting in Las Vegas? What kind of response would you like to see from our political leaders? What is on your mind about this mass shooting? 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can post at ideas@WPR.org or send an email to ideas@WPR. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Think about how you responded. Did you go to Facebook? Did you read the latest articles that the major networks were putting out? How did you react? How did you update yourself? Did you turn away from news sources and perhaps go take a walk or a run? What is your reaction today as you hear reports? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we certainly would like to get your calls coming in. We have an open line for you, that 800-642-1234. And want to hear what is on your mind. Are you concerned about media saying this is the deadliest shooting in modern U.S. history? Do we need to reframe this? Is this an act of terrorism, of domestic terrorism, or not? How are you responding on this day? 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We do have posts coming in. Charles in Wausau emailed, the media should stop asking and looking for indications that this gunman or any gunman had a background of mental health problems. Simply the act of buying an assault weapon is in itself an indication of dangerously neurotic insecurities and or pathological level of powerlessness. Just wanting to own one bespeaks of crippling instability, Charles says. Buying the guns doesn't have to be illegal, but the purchasers should automatically undergo a protocol of psychiatric evaluation and possible surveillance. So that is Charles in Wausau. We're bringing in now our guest here, Russell Berman, who's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers political news. Russell, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Well, starting out with the president, been tweeting about the events in Las Vegas early Monday morning. He addressed the nation, televised remarks just a few hours later. We heard a little bit of the president earlier in the introduction. What about his remarks? How have they been received and the words he used about this?
They were very somber. They were scripted, which is, as we know, is unusual for this president. I think they were, received well. There's the reality is there's always a concern with President Trump that he's going to seek to divide instead of unite. And his comments, his remarks clearly were trying to unite the country. They did not talk about politics. They did not speculate about the motive. There was a report, that was unverified early yesterday that apparently ISIS tried to claim responsibility for this, but he did not mention that. He did not try to put this in the context of international terrorism when the intelligence community said that there was no indication that this was the cause of it. So his remarks were very unifying. So they did not draw any criticism, and they drew some praise. The response from politicians on Capitol Hill was what we've seen before. A lot of thoughts and prayers initially, and then Democrats began, calling for action as they've done each and every time we see mass.
Yeah, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut calling for Congress to, quote, get off its ass and do something in order to prevent further shootings. So very blatant words there from Chris Murphy.
Yeah, and you know, he and other Democrats then took to the Senate floor last night to give speeches on this. They are just very frustrated because we see this again and again, and it has not changed the political dynamic in Washington when it comes to gun control. Republicans, by and large, remain opposed to any measures that would restrict gun rights, even when we see these type of semi-automatic or automatic weapons used that can do a lot of destruction. It just has not changed that dynamic.
Let's take a call on this. Daniel is with us in Madison. Go ahead, Daniel.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that it's about time we take a look at guns and how people have access to guns and other dangerous weapons. If people have issues with other people, it's because they have very easy access to dangerous weapons. They're able to carry out their vengeance. So if there is a way we can close all these loopholes, make having access to guns and other dangerous weapons difficult, I think in the long run, we can prevent this kind of massacres.
Is there a way to close these loopholes, Russell Berman?
Well, that's what many Democrats on Capitol Hill have been calling for. It's what former President Obama called for, was a law that would tighten up the background check laws. There's concerns that you can, even though you're supposed to have to get a background check, there are easy ways to go to a gun show or get a gun, but not by going to a sort of a traditional store. And so, yeah, there is a big push to do this, but it's just simply with Republicans in control on Capitol Hill that's not likely to happen. We have been seeing more action on the state level when it comes to restricting access to guns or to tighten up these procedures. But the federal background check obviously is a responsibility of Congress.
Let's take another call. Jim in Superior. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, hi. What happened out in Vegas was an absolute horrific tragedy. Now, the thing is that the guns and these high-capacity magazines did not fire themselves, did not load the ammunition into themselves, bring themselves into this hotel room, and fire themselves. It is not the gun's fault. It has nothing to do with that. The individual involved, his obvious mental issues, and anything else he has going on is what is to blame. It has nothing to do with the weapons. I own a so-called assault rifle with actual multiple high-capacity magazines. I use them for hunting. I use them for sport shooting. It's just obscene that people think it's the gun's fault that all this is happening.
Russell Berman, can you respond to Jim?
Well, I think the issue that people are raising is the access of somebody who, you know, may or may not have mental illness to these guns, and that's sort of the issue. Yes, there are people, and there are many politicians who are calling to ban these kind of high-capacity magazines, but others are not saying that we should ban them, but we should just be much more careful about who can get access to them.
Hillary Clinton, the Democratic candidate for president in 2016, spent part of yesterday calling out the NRA. Among other things, she tweeted, "We can and must put politics aside, stand up to the NRA, and work together to try to stop this from happening again." Where do relations stand with the NRA?
Well, the NRA spent a lot of money electing Republicans and going after Hillary Clinton in last year's election. They continue to be heavily involved in elections up and down the ballot, federal, state, local. So they're a very powerful force. They have been quiet, as they traditionally are, after this type of of mass shooting. They like to lay low and not comment about that. They are pushing, Hillary Clinton mentioned this in one of the her tweets, they're pushing a bill that would actually make it easier for people to buy silencers for their weapons, and that is up for consideration in Congress right now, although there's no vote scheduled in the House. But Hillary Clinton sort of called that out and said that that could have potentially even made what happened in Las Vegas even worse.
Well, looking ahead on the president's agenda, where do you see him going with this? Do you see him pursuing this agenda at all?
That's unclear. You know, he has been, as on many issues, sort of all over the map on guns over the years, although he, in the past, he's expressed support for some gun control. But he obviously campaigned with the very enthusiastic support of the NRA and gun rights supporters. The White House yesterday said this was not the time to discuss policy, so they really didn't want to weigh in on any of these calls from Democrats for action. So it's hard to see, although, you know, he's, you know, President Trump is much more unpredictable than previous Republican presidents. So I think it's not totally out of the cards that he would want to seek a deal with Democrats on this. But so far, we just don't have any indication that's where his head is at.
Well, Russell, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Berman is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers political news. We also heard earlier in the hour from Susan Silk with the American Red Cross. We heard from Alana Abramson, website writer for Fortune and Time. This hour of The Morning Show was produced by Chris Molina, Brianne Shasso, and Naija Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer and provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up tomorrow at this time, we'll look at the results from a first-of-its-kind study that looks at early adolescent gender identity and development around the world. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.